story not long ago. High on a mountain in Idaho, I was living free. Sold a sawed-off shotgun to a deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down. My good dog killed my boy, my only son, my pride and joy. They shot my wife dead on the floor, holding our baby in the cabin door.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down.
Down. Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down. And you want to go build a cabin in Idaho, in Idaho. If you're living free, boys don't sell no shotgun, no deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please,
please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down.
On Ruby Ridge,
please don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down.
You're listening to KHENLP 106.9, Salida, Colorado. And I guess I'm going to have to play another song here because I somehow disconnected my guest. So we'll go ahead.
Pushing folks around. Janie's in the back seat, polishing the crown. We're going down, going down.
Well, Bush 2 is in the White House, just passing tax reforms, giving trillions to his rich friends and stealing from the poor. Don't blink your eyes, he'll sell the store.
Corporations in the Pentagon just cooking up the wars. Condis in the State House saying fuck you to the world. Within the Ocon, in the Ocon.
Well, Poppy Bush and Baby Bush and the party of God, that spelled G for guns and O for oil and D for drugs. They gave us 911, was an inside job.
George Bush in the White House spreading fear across the land, tearing up our Bill of Rights as fast as they can. War on terror, such a scam.
Well, Collins at the UN just showing diagrams. Can't you see those weapons just scattered across the land? He's making deals, he's shaking hands.
Well, Rummy's in the desert, got blood on his hands. Wolfie's at the World Bank, making new demands. We'll take your oil, you keep the sand.
We got Abu Ghraib in the Middle East, Guantanamo down south. Congress got that Patriot Act just shoved on down its mouth. They took our Constitution and threw it out.
Well, Karl Rove in the White House and they say he's Bush's brain. All his corporate buddies and their voting machines. We cast our votes, they wipe them clean.
States and preemptive war, the Fourth Reich's here in America.
King George in the White House just pushing folks around. Chains in the backseat, polishing the crown. We're going down, we're going down.
Do I have Eric and Vicki?
I'm here.
Okay, all right, just a second. I'll go ahead and get started now. Just a second. You're listening to KHENLP-FM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. We're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest, they are now available at www.givemesometruth.info and or link to the khen.org website. And my co-host tonight is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and our guest is Vicki Davis. And I'm going to let Vicki tell us a little bit about herself, but she is returning. We had her last year, and she had a lot of good information. She's a researcher, and I'm going to go ahead and, oh, one other thing here. The views expressed on this program are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And support for KHEN and TruthQuest is brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Property, Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at coloradohomeproperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. Okay, Eric and Vicki?
Oh, okay, well, my name is Vicki Davis. Like you said, I was a computer systems analyst working primarily in mainframe shops and for government, you know, on big systems. Corporate systems, and around the year 2000, couldn't find any contracts anymore, and I started researching on the Internet, found out about outsourcing, and I've been at war ever since. That made me angry, and I started researching with outsourcing, and then progressed to so many topics I couldn't even list them for you, but they're all connected. It's all connected to the transformation that they are trying to bring about, which is a virtual world governance model.
And Vicki, you have a lot of this material on your website, which is www.channelingreality.com. So if our listeners would like to download some of your articles. There are many posted there. And as I gather, you're always adding and revising your website. Would that be right?
I'm always adding to it. Yeah, I haven't done any major revisions in a long time, which is why you see the basic outline of it that I started with. And then all of the articles that I have running down the center have been the things that I've written about as time has gone on that pertain to the other ones, but I just haven't found the time to organize them and, you know, get them sorted out. And so it's kind of a free-for-all, you know, looking at the individual articles.
Yeah, just for the benefit of the listeners, again, we talked about this when we interviewed you in January 4th of 2007. The way you have your website structured, you have four main topics. The silent war, in which you talk about how privatized government is conducting a low-intensity conflict, i.e., which is terrorism, against the people of the United States. It's kind of an information and cultural war. Then the next section is the new federalism, how government has been reinvented to be a market-based government, essentially a partnership between government and big corporations, which, of course, amounts to fascism. Then you talk about Agenda 21 on your third topic, and then finally the coup d'etat, the 9-1-1 North American Union connection. So if we could start, we did talk about some of these last time, and I'm sure we will again, but if we could start with an area that I know you have expertise in, and that is the computer systems that were in use on 9/11/2001, specifically a piece of software called PTEC. And we've heard in various 911 citizens' inquiries the testimony of another systems analyst named Indira Singh, who supposedly was working for J.P. Morgan Bank on PTEC, and then she wound up testifying in this 911 citizens' hearing. And you wound up, as I understand it, you wound up kind of questioning her on some of her testimony, and that led you to some different opinions. So could you tell us a little bit about that situation, and then maybe we can explore the meaning of this? And I think it's very important because a lot of people believe that 911 was a computer crime as well as other type of crime.
Uh-huh. Well, the Indira Singh part of the story, she was working at J.P. Morgan, and this was all documented, by the way, on the Mike Rupert website. And it's been a while, so if I don't get it exactly right, you probably can still retrieve her stories about it. But essentially, she was doing a contract for J.P. Morgan to look at software to install. What her description of it was that it was a risk management system, and essentially what this software would allow them to do is if they had incoming transactions that appeared to be invalid, they could shut their systems down to block the attack. I guess the way I would see it now is that it would be like a denial of service attack or something like that. But anyway, partway through, she'd scheduled a presentation by a company named PTEC, and they were supposed to come and demo the software. And according to her, about 10 minutes into the presentation, she left the room and called some friends that she knew and told them that she was very suspicious of the company that was in giving this presentation. And she told them the name of the company was PTEC, and they told her to get those people out of there. And you know, don't let them touch anything, don't let them do anything. So, you know, and she told this story in a video. I guess it was to maybe that 911 commission, independent commission or whatever, but it was the video was posted on Snowshoe Films, and I saw that video. And but she never said what it was that this company did, that these people did, that made her suspicious 10 minutes into the presentation. And so I was really curious about that because I've been in on a lot of presentations, and basically, you know, you don't even get the glad handing done 10 minutes into the presentation. So I asked her about that, and I was directed to Mike Rupert's website. And essentially her description of it was that what they did was to basically offer to hack J.P. Morgan's systems. And in the world of software consultants, I mean, that's like a bank robber walking into the bank and offering to crack your safe. You know, it's just not, it's something that you just don't do. And so, you know, I was highly suspicious of that. But it turns out that the software that they were selling, or that they were presenting, PTEC, it has connections going back to the 1990s to a program called Promise. And Promise was written by a man named, I think it was Bill Hamilton. And what that software allowed, it was written for the Justice Department, and it allowed them to be able to traverse systems, I guess, to track bankruptcy assets throughout the system and beyond, I guess. The description of it, as far as I could understand, sounded like the only way that that could be done was if it had a backdoor access to through the IBM controllers. And the controllers are what managed the communications. And the thing is that kind of knowledge is very, very arcane. The only people that really knew about that kind of stuff were really highly trained technical support people. And so they were a rarity always. So I figured, you know, the only way that that could be is if IBM was involved. And when I was researching Promise, I did find that, let me back up a little bit. Okay, with this Promise software that Bill Hamilton had written for the Justice Department, the Justice Department confiscated the software, basically, and they wouldn't pay him for it. So he had to sue, and he was a small company, so basically they were just waiting him out. And the head of the Justice Department at that time was Edwin Meese. And so he sued, and he was just about to go under, and I found an article that said that guess who bailed him out? IBM. So that means that, you know, IBM, when they bail somebody out, that means that they own that software.
Could I jump in for a second?
Sure.
And have you continue, hopefully, in a second. But I should add, I think that the list of PTEC's clients is very distinguished. It included the U.S. Senate, the CIA, the FBI, the President, the House of Representatives, the Secret Service, the Department of Navy, Air Force, Department of Energy, U.S. Forest Service, the FAA, the U.S. Post Office, the IRS, and NORAD, I believe. And of course, the reason this is important is because on the morning of 9/11, the communications between FAA and NORAD failed. Now, a lot of us who are researching 911 think that those planes did not strike the buildings, but there's no question that those planes were hijacked, and they went somewhere. And obviously, our communication system failed along with FAA and NORAD. So that said, could you continue your story?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Going back to J.P. Morgan and the PTEC people, now the people who were presenting this software were Arabs, Muslims, I assume, which is really convenient, you know, because it supports the official storyline.
Well, this is Singh's story, right? Singh says that the people supporting the software were Arabs.
Yes.
Or is that the case?
Well, no, it's her story, which,
okay,
you know, I have no reason not to believe, because if I remember correctly, I did a search and I found the IBM documentation for the product that they were selling, PTEC, that they were selling in conjunction with IBM, and it's called the framework. The name of it is Framework, and basically what it was is a piece of software that would, once it was installed, it would produce tables and lists of all of the resources on the computer, which means all of the communications controllers, all of their databases, all the elements, all the just everything. You know, it was kind of like the window on the world no pun intended, into a computer system. And I do believe that the names that are on that document are Arab names, but I can't say that for absolute certain. But okay, now, and I know this PTEC software is involved in 911 because I heard one of the senators mention the name of it one day to somebody else. You know how they talk on the floor of the Senate sometimes, and he did mention PTEC. So I know it is involved.
Now, according to Indira Singh's account and your account, the special thing about PTEC was that it had a back door, so-called back door. Could you explain what that is?
Mm-hmm. A back door would be a way to get into the software by stealth. You know, there's the front door, you know, that everybody is aware of, and you have your user ID and your password, and it's a very upfront kind of thing. But many times, especially with this junk PC software, you know, there'll be a backdoor programmed in that programmers put in there just in case, you know, they mess up and can't get in through the front door. So, but I think in the case of the PTEC software that started out as the Promise software, I think it was programmed in intentionally.
Okay. Now, in your article that I saw, you mentioned something about some experience that you had with a very, very low-tech system where there was kind of a forklift out back that had a wireless connection to the hard drive of the computer, and that they might have used something like that for the back door?
You know, being a systems analyst programmer, when I heard about the Promise PTEC software, it just intrigued me. You know, it's one of those kinds of things where your mind goes into full mode. How did this thing work? How could it possibly have worked? And just happens to be that about in 1976, when I started into programming, or 1977, around that time frame, I started in the business in Silicon Valley. And there was a company there that I interviewed for that was writing a system for forklifts. You know, in the big military warehouses, you know, in the old days when you had forklifts and they were moving pallets around, everything was done by paper. You know, the forklift driver puts a pallet here, and then he's got to stop and write it on a piece of paper where he put it, and so that they could then retrieve it at some time in the future. Well, what this company was doing was that they were working on wireless communications so that the forklift operator could have a terminal on his forklift that would communicate with a computer that was some distance away in an office, so that the computer could be updated dynamically with where the pallets are that the forklift operator is putting them. And it occurred to me that could have been a way that they had as a back door to get into a mainframe computer system, because it would be something that nobody was looking for. You know, you look for bugs in software, but you don't look for a Trojan horse in a piece of hardware on a circuit board. Okay? So what they could have done, and this is speculation on my part, but it's a way that it could have been done. If they had a passive transmitter on a circuit board that would just sit there, you know, waiting for somebody to say, hello, I'm here, you know, it communicates back. which is the way that, that all wireless communications work. You know, there's the signal, it's received, there's a handshake, and, you know, then they start communicating. Well, all they would have, if they did have something like that on a circuit board, all they would have to record is like the first 25 characters that were entered in after any period of time, you know, exceeding, say, I don't know, 20 minutes, half an hour, hour, because on every single corporate and government computer system, if you walk away from your machine, it, after a certain number of minutes, it automatically goes into lock mode so that nobody can use your terminal, your monitor, while you're away. So all they would have to do is to record the keystrokes, have a keystroke recorder, which would be a very small program, just to record, you know, the first 20 keystrokes after a period of inactivity. And they would have the way in for anybody in the system, anybody in the whole company that they wanted to get their password and login.
See, and what else could they do with this? They could steal money. They could put people on the payroll. They could
they could wreak havoc. I mean, yeah. Whenever anybody thinks about breaking into computer systems, they only think about stealing money. But I mean, if you're, it depends on what your intentions are. I mean, you could wreak havoc. You could get somebody fired by doing things on the, making it look like they did things on the computer that they didn't do, but actually that you did. And because nobody is really looking for any kind of hardware problem, you know, they're only looking for software problems, and they all know the systems, it's really kind of a perfect tool for all kinds of, I'll call it mischief, but it's not really mischief because it's really an insidious way to attack a corporation or a government, for that matter.
So basically one person could have disabled the entire system on the morning of 911?
Yes, yes. They could have shut that line down. Okay, now, I don't think we explained how that line worked. What they had was that the FAA and the NMCC had an open line of communications for when there was a situation. And it was kind of an emergency line. And what it did was to allow both sides to hear everything that was going on so that they could each react to it. Okay, now what the FAA guy said was that he started up that emergency line and it was going. And then he went about his business, you know, dealing with the situation, thinking that the line was working. At the NMCC, just coincidentally on that morning, there was somebody who had just this was like his first day on the job after being qualified to run that desk at the NMCC. His boss, I think his name was Winthorpe or something like that, he coincidentally had a meeting that he had to go to that morning, and so he turned the console over to this new guy. And I think probably the new guy didn't know enough really about the system to know that he wasn't hearing what he should be hearing. So he didn't know that it was down. And the FAA person didn't know that they weren't communicating.
Now the NMCC stands for what?
Oh, it's the National Military Command and Control or something like that. It's a military facility.
Yeah.
It was the connection between the military and the FAA.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, what Indira Singh, the information that she gave out was that Markle is a foundation that has worked with the government, for the government, as in kind of a consulting capacity and contractor capacity for a long time. Okay, Markle had been working with PTEC on the FAA systems for the whole year prior to 9/11.
Markle is a corporation?
It's a corporation and a foundation. It's a non-profit.
Okay.
Call it that. Okay, now what I recently found out about Markle, and I think this is very significant and probably might have played a factor in it, is that under the UN, you know, the UN, UNESCO, the social side of it, they have, the way that system works is that they basically have people that are part of a commission, and they all get together and they come up with a recommendation, and the recommendation is turned into a plan of action, and then countries all over the world that are participating in the UN implement the plan of action. And this is an obligation that they have as being a member of the United Nations. And
Like
Agenda 21. Okay, in the year 2000, probably backing up to the G8 meeting in Houston in 1999, but certainly at the there was a meeting in Okinawa, Japan in 2000, and the objective of that meeting was to talk about the digital divide, meaning the gap between the developed countries' knowledge and use of computers and the internet and the developing and undeveloped countries, and you know the possibilities for all kinds of things, you know, improving the lives of people that live in these undeveloped and developing countries. Well, the initiative, Bridging the Digital Divide, they had another meeting in Genoa where they presented the plan of action, and the plan of action called for nonprofits, governments, and corporations to do everything possible that they could to bring the people from these other countries, I'm just going to call them undeveloped or underdeveloped, but to bring them up to speed so that they could get the benefits of the Internet, which, you know, we could do a whole show on you know, I mean, what is a person, you know, living in a village with no electricity going to do with an Internet connection? But that's beside the point. Anyway, the partnership team that was involved in the implementation of the plan of action was Markle Foundation, Anderson Consulting, and the person who was the president of the Markle Foundation at that point in time was Zoe Baird. And Zoe Baird was involved with the Chubb Corporation. And the Chubb Corporation and AIG were behind the Knowledge Trade Initiative to export. The objective was to export all of our knowledge jobs over to India. And that means programming, engineers, film industry, biotechnology, you know, all of our high-end jobs going over to India. Okay, now if you look at our economy, we don't have manufacturing anymore. We were dependent on those information technology jobs, and fully like 65% of our economy were in knowledge jobs of all different types. And but with this knowledge trade initiative, and it's interesting that they called themselves the .force.com. If you do a search on the internet, you can look for .force.org, I guess it is, and find information about these people. But basically, it was after 9/11, on November 9th, 2001, George Bush signed the Knowledge Trade Initiative with India.
On the internet, it also says that they were dealing in areas of health and national security.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's one department of government, I forget which one it is, I can't remember whether it's the NIH or CDC. If you look at the names of the people that are working in that department, they're all foreign names. They're not Americans. And I have my opinion on that, that I think it's kind of like a fifth column in our government.
Okay, so Markle, to take this back to our PTEC connection, Markle was a nonprofit that had worked for the government that had been working with PTEC for an entire year. Now we have a little background on Markle, but
right,
we're still trying to figure out exactly what happened with PTEC on the morning of 9/11 and who was in a position to control that.
Well, okay, here's what I suspect Markle would have been. Markle, because they were leading this program to and basically the only way that you could bring non-technical people up to technical speed is to bring them into an organization where you have senior level people where they could actually be doing things. And I kind of, after I read that about Markle being involved in the Genoa plan of action, being one of the implementation partners, I suspect that they probably brought in PTEC being perhaps Arabs, I don't know, whoever it was, junior level programmers, and they were the ones that may have been working on that communications system for the FAA.
Well, okay, let me give you a little bit of the scenario that's put together in an article by Christopher Bolin. This is out of a book called Solving 911. The chapter is The Architecture of Terror, Mapping the Israeli Network Behind 911. And he makes the point that Michael Goff was a key person at PTEC when it was founded in 1994, and he is a young Zionist lawyer from Worcester, Massachusetts, who subsequently worked for Guardium, an Israeli software company tied to military intelligence, in other words, Mossad. And he's saying that there is a crucial connection between the Israeli intelligence, Mossad, and this suite of companies, including MITRE, which also shared a space with PTEC, Guardium, and PTEC.
Oh, maybe it was MITRE that was working with. I might have given you a bum steer. Maybe it was MITRE that was working with PTEC. But Markle would be involved in that, in probably because I did find information on Markle being connected with that,
mm-hmm,
and with the Zoe Baird connection. But that might be a bum steer. Maybe my memory is wrong on that. So anybody that's listening to this, research that part of it.
Okay, so. Anyway, he says Goff was working for Guardium, a software company run by Israeli military intelligence officers, that PTEC software was, which has spy surveillance and intervention capabilities, according to experts like Indira Singh, and was running on nearly every U.S. government computer network at the time of 911. Goff had personally been responsible for procuring all software for the quote-unquote Arab-owned PTEC and for marketing PTEC's enterprise software. He went on to work for Guardium, which is a branch of Research and Development Department of the Israeli Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I would have to think that, and this is my opinion only, but I would have to think that given that setup, that IBM was a very careful company, and I think if they were dealing with an Arab company like that, I would think that they were using them as a front. I'll just say it straight up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's go back to the connection with Inflaw and IBM, because it goes back before PTEC and Promise to a previous computer program, which apparently was involved in some mischief and was caught, and there was a investigation in Congress. Is that right?
Yes, that was in 1992, and some of the documents that I have were from that investigation. And what they were finding was that any information that the FBI might have or when they were doing an investigation, they would get ready to do a raid or serve a search warrant or something like that, and they would go to execute it, and everybody would be gone. All the evidence would be gone. You know, it was almost like the criminals were being informed that they were about to be busted, and so. I think through that investigation, that's how they found that back door in the Promise software. But of course, you know, software can be, they might seize one copy of it, but you can make zillions of copies of it. And apparently they did, and it got spread all around. So who knows how many people have copies of that software. And apparently, Whoever did get it ultimately succeeded in getting it installed on government computers, not only our government's computers, but on computers all around the world.
Wow! So that backdoor capability then would be available to those people in government computers all around the world.
Yes. It's really insidious, and I've tried to think, you know, how would you deal with that? How would systems people deal with that? And I really don't know. I don't know, because I don't know how you could change the architecture in such a way that it wouldn't function, you know, because of the physics of the machine and the software, that the underlying software, you know, the interface that you see on the computer is just it's a top level slice of all the software that's on the machine. And what runs the machine is just layers and layers and layers and layers of computer code to make everything work. And so what appears to you to be a very simple interface, there's really massive amounts of complexity the farther down you go to the machine level. And so, you know, I don't know how you would protect against something like that.
Well, basically, I think what's coming out of this discussion anyway is that through its connection with PTEC, IBM perhaps was a major player in the 911 crime, or could have been, and could also be a major player in ongoing criminal or other activities worldwide right now with this capability.
Yeah. Well, I kind of think so. I don't know if you remember back in the early 90s when IBM's stock was arbitraged and their stock dropped down, their stock value dropped down to like $50 a share or something like that. And at that point, new management came in. You know, the old IBM management came in. And since that time, the whole culture at IBM changed. And one of the people that came in that was the CEO was Louis Gerstner Jr. Mm-hmm. And he was at IBM for several years. And then he ended up at the Carlyle Group.
Uh-huh.
So...
Well, I do know. I've got a video called The Corporation. Have you seen the video, The Corporation?
I did a couple years ago.
Well, it towards the end, it's a long video, but towards the end it talks about the role of IBM in Nazi Germany to help the Nazis process the people they were sending off to various prison camps. Apparently it was a job for a computer because there was a great amount of complexity to decide who was going to go where. And IBM computers were leased to Hitler and the Nazis to make this process more efficient.
Oh, yeah. Edwin Black wrote a book about that, and I think he called it The Holocaust or something, but
yeah.
IBM and the Holocaust.
Paul Watson was the CEO or something like that?
Yeah, Thomas Watson.
Thomas Watson, yeah.
Uh-huh. And, yeah, that's a really interesting story, and... We were going to talk about the medical system tonight, and what they're doing, you know, the whole new federalism, there was a whole paradigm shift in our government during the Clinton administration. Al Gore basically did what he called reinventing government.
Mm-hmm.
And basically they changed it from a government to what was the German, I believe to be the German model of capitalism, which is that the government owned corporations and foundations, but they appeared to be a capitalist country, but they really weren't. They were socialist.
And fascist.
Yeah, fascist. Uh-huh. I don't know. I don't know what the difference is. You know, it all seems the same to me.
That's what I get the impression of anymore.
Well, I can explicate a little bit. I mean, theoretically, anyway, fascism is when you have a merger of state and corporate power. Whether the corporations own the state or the state owns the corporation, their interests are aligned. And of course, we've got that in spades here now in this country. Mussolini himself said fascism should really be called corporatism, for it is the merger of state and corporate power. Now, fascism under Germany was officially called national socialism. So it was a kind of socialism, but it was a corporate governance structure. Meanwhile, according to some people, of course, you had socialism and communism going on in the Soviet Union, and you had welfare socialism going on in the United States under FDR. So essentially the rulers of the world were experimenting with different brands of socialism simultaneously, kind of to see which models they liked the best, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, Germany was too, but they were doing it, I think it was Ludwig von Mises who discovered that it was actually the government that owned the corporations.
Right.
And so really there was no difference in the model other than that they pretended to be capitalist. And there's a book called The Arms of Krupp, and it gives a history of the Krupp Arms Company. And in that book, they talk about how good Krupp was to their employees. And so, if you know, when you're looking at the social welfare models, you'd have to factor in that the German corporations were really very good to their employees, and the Germans were very loyal to the corporations because of that. And so I think in both models you have the social welfare state. It's mm-hmm. just the pretense of capitalism versus the non-pretense.
Well, isn't that kind of what we have now?
Yeah, I'd say that's what I would say now, what we have. We have the pretense. I don't think Congress really controls very much.
So you would trace this, the origins of the what you call market-based democracy, back to Clinton and Gore in the 1990s. Is there a particular document or meeting where that this is laid out in a kind of a obvious way?
Yeah, at the Harvard JFK School of Government, there is a paper that was written by Zelikow, John Deutsch, and Ashton Carter, and the name of it is Catastrophic Terrorism, a National Policy, or something to that effect. And the subtitle underneath that is called Visions of a 21st Century Government. And if you click on that link, you go to a page that doesn't seem to have a lot of information, but it does say market-based governance. Okay. Now, here's something interesting. If you go to the American Solutions website, which is Newt Gingrich's website, there's a woman who gives a video presentation. Her name is Elaine Carmack or something like that. And she does a presentation called The End of Government as We Know It. And basically what they're talking about is replacing government with Congress defines the framework of programs, and then both Congress and the private sector, foundations and whoever, actually implement the programs on the ground in the communities. And so basically you have that's the communist system. That's the way the communist system works. In Russia, they did have government and government employees, but the government employees didn't really have much power. It was the Communist Party members who had the power. And whether they were inside of government or outside of government didn't matter. But it was the party people who had the power. And that's essentially the system that they set up for us under this reinvention of government. You know, the people that control the money have the power.
Now, Newt Gingrich's website is what again?
American Solutions.
AmericanSolutions.com or org or something?
I think it's .org.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But at the highest level, what they're planning on is a virtual government where you have all of your policies and governance comes from a central source. Over in Europe somewhere, European Union, Geneva, where the UN is. All of the policy would come from there, and it would flow to the through the non-governmental organizations. But it's a virtual government, so there's no real structure that you can point to and say this Department of Government is responsible, and here's the line of authority all the way up, you know, so that your state representative can, you know, do something for you if something goes wrong. That's not the way this system works. The way this system works is that the NGOs get their marching orders from the Comintern, and our Congress passes the framework, but that's basically just making it look good. You know, it's the facade of a real government. But the actual implementation of the programs is done by the NGOs. And a good way to look at that is to look at the sustainable development groups. Follow what they do, trace back the policies, and you'll see they go all the way back up to the UN.
Yeah, don't they even have to sign on to some kind of UN Agenda 21 rules when they become a nonprofit like that?
Yeah, in order to participate, they have to agree to abide by, you know, all these programs that the UN is doing. They basically have to, you know, sign on as soldiers in the UN army of NGOs.
Okay, back in the old days, really before I was paying too much attention, I don't know about you, the McCarthy era, et cetera, a lot of right-wing people in America were very skeptical of the United Nations, thinking it was a bunch of communists. Can we now say that they were right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And
so their fears were justified, and the liberals who thought the UN was a good idea were not on the ball in this regard. Would you say that's true?
Yes. But you know what? In all fairness, in our country, most of the news coverage on the UN had to do with peacekeeping. They almost never mentioned UNESCO. I remember UNESCO from when I was a kid, you know, maybe 12 years old, when it was being called a communist organization. But after that went out of the news, and I never heard about it again until, you know, just a few years ago. I forget what it was. I started looking into the education issues. And these education researchers kept sending me UN stuff, UNESCO stuff. And the most active part of the UN affecting your life is coming from what they call the economic social side of the UN, which includes UNESCO, which is UNESCO. And they have all these different branches of the UN, and each one of those branches has programs and NGOs that are working to implement those programs around the world. And they are communist. They're doing so many, all of the problems that we're having with property rights in this country and these environmental groups, suing to keep you from using your property. All of that derives from the UN's programs, and in particular, Agenda 21.
Okay, so we've had some very interesting guests yourself, certainly amongst the most interesting. One of them was Joan Vion, who has been following international UN meetings for 10 or 15 years, and she says there are literally thousands of these international meetings every year around the world. And every major sector of the structure of how you would organize the world government is being addressed now. So she would say the world government is not coming, it's here. And she would say basically that the logic that they use to promote world government goes something like this. There's too many people on the planet. There's a scarcity of resources. Humans with their affluent lifestyle, especially in the first world, are consuming too much. We are polluting too much. We are causing climate change, and this is going to be the worst disaster in all of nature's history, you might say. And therefore, what we have to do is reduce the population down to, say, 1 or 2 billion people or even less from the present 6.5 billion, and we have to give over control, give our sovereignties, essentially, of our countries over to the one world structure that the UN would be uniquely qualified to administer. Would you say that's a pretty good summary of the logic that is supposed to lead us to want to give up our power to the UN?
Yes. Yes, Joan Vion is just, she's right on top of it. Did she explain to you about the what'd she call it, the family food ratio or something
yes.
like
well,
that?
Well, I've got her video on world governmental structure.
Yeah.
She did not explain, I don't think, in our interview, but if you would like to talk about that, that would be fine.
Well, what it is, basically, you're familiar with all the performance measurements that are going into place, right? Under the heading of accountability. And this all ties back to the computer systems. This is why the computer systems are so important and why they're trying to tag everything and inventory everything and monitor everybody's movements. Because that's how they plan on managing this whole world governance system. Is by the computer systems, by computer reports that will report the performance of everything. Okay? So, and ultimately, under a World Bank program, what they plan on doing is to be able to measure your productivity relative to the amount of world resources that you use. And if you come up negative, you're a useless eater and you have to be eliminated. I mean, that's the bottom line. They put it into much nicer language, but that's the bottom line of what that ratio is. It's measuring your resource utilization relative to how much you produce.
Vicki?
Go ahead, Melanie.
Okay, can I go ahead and get our legal ID, which is, this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida Community Supported Radio. And support for KHEN and TruthQuest is brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Property Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access. Just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at ColoradoHomeProperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. And this evening, we're interviewing our guest, Vicki Davis, and I have my co-host with me, Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and this is TruthQuest. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so Vicki, you're saying this is called the family dependence ratio?
Yes, that's what it is, family dependency ratio.
Family dependency ratio. Now, the last the words that you used at the end there, you said, okay, if you're if the ratio of your productivity relative to the amount of resources you consume is perhaps negative, that you consume more than you produce, that you would perhaps have to be eliminated as a useless eater. Now, does it say that anywhere?
It doesn't say that officially anywhere, but they do talk about productivity and resource utilization, and it's kind of implicit in what they write. Okay, like I found a World Bank report that where they were talking about poverty reduction strategies and development, and what this report was laying out was a strategy for the undeveloped countries in order to get development dollars. They had to reduce poverty. Okay? Now, if you think about that, think about yourself as a government leader. You have to reduce poverty in order to get development dollars. Well, how do you reduce poverty without the development dollars? So basically what they do is they implicitly set up a situation where in order to get development dollars, they have to eliminate populations of poor people. And if you do some reading on what's going on over in Africa, poor people are being eliminated. There was one city, I forget what the name of it was, but they had poor people that had like a tent city outside of one of their main cities. They ran all those people off, you know. But the thing is, there's no economy to run them off to. So basically, they ran them off into the jungle to starve to death.
Yes, we've certainly seen some big genocide events in Africa the last 20, 30 years that relate to CIA interventions, et cetera, and setting up conflicts between one tribe and another, and then flooding the area with guns, and then setting off a trigger event, and putting in a puppet government, which leads to the kind of atrocities that you see in Rwanda and under Idi Amin, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So Africa has certainly been targeted deliberately so for genocide for a long time. Wouldn't you say that?
Yes, I would. I would.
And now it's UN policy. I'm trying to track this down. You say poverty reduction strategies. Poverty reduction would be one of the official goals in all kinds of UN documents, right?
Yeah. The whole campaign is poverty reduction, you know. They are so clever about how they phrase things, the way they frame things, and the words that they use. But if you read the documents very carefully and you think about what's the goal of this implementation? What does it really mean? You can see how really, truly evil it is underlying the high flying words.
Right.
And I have that report. I'll send it to you if you'd like.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'd like to see that.
Mm-hmm.
I have to make an admission here just in case it might be of interest to somebody. I've been teaching human ecology for, since 1990, at the university where I teach. And it's basically set up as a litany of environmental issues and problems. I now realize that teaching from the books I have been teaching from, I have, in effect, been kind of training the young of America to accept the definitions that I just said, which is that, you know, we consume too much, that there's climate change, that there's a scarcity of resources, et cetera. And I've been using a book this semester called The Great Turning from Empire to Earth Community, written by David Corton. And I used it 2 years ago for the first time. I thought it was a great book. And now recently, I have done all this research now on Agenda 21 and the UN's real goals of one world government. And David Corton is a cheerleader for the UN. And he's getting his idea of Earth Community right out of the UN Earth Charter, which was written by Marie Strong and Mikhail Gorbachev. Which calls really, they want that to be a new Ten Commandments for life in the 21st century for all citizens of the world. So what they envision basically is tearing up the Judeo-Christian tradition, which of course our Western civilization is based on, and substituting kind of a pagan, modern pagan witchcraft hybrid, from what I gather.
Mm-hmm.
It is very insidious, and it's so insidious that relatively smart people like me can be fooled for decades.
Yeah. Well, who is going to argue with protecting the environment?
Right.
I love animals. I love the wilderness. I love open spaces, but that's really secondary, I think, to what the real agenda is. And at its very bottom, most base, it's eugenics. Going back, you know, to the same old stuff. Let's eliminate the imperfect and keep only the perfect.
So we can look at the modern environmental movement and trace it back to eugenics. Would you say that?
Yes.
At least the way it is being manipulated.
Uh-huh.
And so, it traces back to some of the same people. Now, I've read that a guy named George Perkins Marsh was kind of the first person who formulated the idea that the environmental movement, that the would-be rulers of the world could use the environmental movement to get traction and usher in their multi-generational plan. I don't know if that's the case or not, but I think that it's pretty easy to demonstrate that modern population policies of the UN are definitely traceable back to the eugenics movement, which goes back to Yale George Herbert Walker, who was the great-grandfather of our president, was very big into eugenics. And, of course, the Yale eugenicists wrote the stuff that Hitler used when he experimented with killing inferiors.
Uh-huh.
So how does that set with you on and teaching now, with now that you know this?
Good question. Good question. Well, I'm an honest guy, and I have a hard time, you know, keeping my mouth shut, having learned what I've learned. So I'm trying to be fair and give both sides, but I definitely tell my students that, you know, look behind the ideas of Earth Community and see there may be a connection with the Earth Charter and the UN and even communism. You know, we had a guest who said that, you know, one of the factions that's trying to rule the world is the watermelons. They're red. They're green on the outside and red on the inside.
Oh, perfect. Yes, that's pretty perfect. I found a quote from, it was in a document that a guy wrote for the UN. And the way he defined environment, he defined it as everything that we touch and everything that touches us. So basically, it's totalitarian control of everything. When you talk about, when the UN and all of their NGOs talk about the environment, they are talking about everything, absolutely everything. And if you really start looking into, like, what's happening in the field of education and how they're transforming the schools and they're elevating the environment, earth worship in the schools, another thing that they're doing concurrently with that is, and this occurs in their books and in library books and stories and stuff, the morality lessons of, like, for example, there's a book, and I can't recall the name of it offhand, but I could find it. But it was written for about fifth graders. And what it was is a morality play that asked the question, is it fair for older people to be living and using resources when there are young children that don't have enough to eat? And, you know, what are the moral issues involved in that? You know, does the older person have an obligation to die, which is, you know, kind of, well, I'm sure you're very familiar how you can write a story and lead people to the conclusion that you want them to have. Every single writer in the world does it.
Yeah.
And they're writing those kinds of stories for children. And what that is conditioning their minds to be able to accept those kinds of moral decisions. I mean, you know, when you present a moral decision like that to somebody our age, we think, well, there's got to be an alternative. You know, we can't just murder people because that's wrong. And so there has to be an alternative. But that's not that they're not that's not what they're leading children to think. You know, they're leading them to think that it's morally okay that we might have to eliminate the elderly so that the young can live, kind of thing.
Well, are we looking at the destruction and the takedown of Western civilization here?
Yes, I think so.
If you consider that our civilization really is based on Christianity, and that this movement, which we can call, I guess, what do you want to call it, the New World Order, the One World Government, the One World Conspiracy, the whatever, this one of its chief objectives is to take down and destroy Christianity and replace it with their own Earth Charter type of pagan spirituality.
I don't see how any religion can survive that. Do you?
Survive what?
Survive them taking down, you know, what you were just talking about with Christianity. I mean, Christianity wouldn't survive, but I don't see how any other religion could survive that same litmus.
Well, that's where Darwin comes in, and that's kind of an interesting thing, you know, survival of the fittest.
Well, people in the Soviet Union, of course, were told that, you know, that's an atheistic country for 70 years, and religion was persecuted, and just from, you know, reading people like Solzhenitsyn, it would appear that, you know, people would pass scraps of paper back and forth with little bits of biblical scripture on it. So the human spirit is very hard to destroy. It's very resilient. And after 70 years of brutal communism in Soviet Union, I think, you know, people are at base, they're still good people over there. At least many.
Well, I think it takes a person has to be a psychopath to fully buy into eugenics, and I don't think that the majority of people are psychopaths.
Right.
Now, if you raise children grow up to believe what they were taught. But I don't know if you can condition and teach inhumanity. Maybe you can. I don't know.
Well,
I
think you can. I mean, this is what the military does to some extent. You know, teach people to kill, put them in the position to kill, train them to kill. You know, even if it takes drugs or you know, something like that to make them more likely to kill. I mean, you're trying to take an average person who will at all costs avoid killing another person and break down that natural tendency. You know, certainly we know that they can do that. One article which came out recently called Twilight of the Psychopath by Kevin Barrett said he agreed that 5% of the population approximately is psychopathic. But that under some circumstances, another 10 or 15% can act as psychopaths, for instance, during a war or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So you can break them down, make people temporarily into a psychopath. And I think by torture, you can perhaps cause some people to become psychopaths.
Do you not think that maybe PTSD has a huge reflection on this, why we have such a huge part of our population being affected by it, not only because of the chemicals and the medications and that sort, but it's because of the environment they were exposed to?
I would have to think so. I mean, I can't even imagine being in that kind of an environment where you know that you're killing women and children and just, you know, everything that's living, you know, where it's kind of an annihilation. But you have to do it because it's either them or you. I would think that would really, for a normal person, I would think that would really tear them apart. You know, but then that's my take on it. I don't know that I'm average in that, but I kind of think I suspect that I am. I mean, I don't think that just because guys are in the military and that they've learned to use guns and that they are prepared to shoot other people, I don't think that makes them psychopathic. I think they go in with the idea of defense. And in a defensive situation, I could probably be as dangerous as anybody else. But you know, when you get into like massive killing, and you know there are innocents involved, I would think that would really tear at you.
Well, you know, we have a whole sea change now, so that a lot of killing can be done on computers, like a video game, and
mm-hmm.
we have, of course, trained an entire younger generation to play kill video games, you know. So this would, I think, be a desensitization training. I don't know how effective it is, but I would imagine that if somebody's on the borderline. But we're speculating here. There's a great quote I've got here by Kurt Vonnegut There is no reason good can't triumph over evil if only angels will get organized along the lines of the mafia.
Oh, I like that. That's good.
So we are dealing with a very, very highly organized group and very motivated. The movie that I just reviewed on my website, Missing Links, talks about the degree of infiltration of Zionists into all aspects of our society, many of whom actually hold joint passports, joint citizenship with both the United States and Israel. Israel, through a law in 1967, Israelis have been granted the right, the only country, the only nationality to have the right to be joint citizens, and they can actually hold office in the United States.
And so they hold all of the highest offices.
And they hold a lot of the highest offices in the judiciary. They're certainly well placed in business and in government. There's an article that came out, 103 prime suspects for people who were involved in 9/11, and something like 26% are Zionists or people who hold the dual American Israeli citizenship. People like Michael Chertoff and Paul Wolfowitz, et cetera. But then another 33 or 4% is people who currently or formerly worked in the White House, and another 20% is current or former CEOs. So, that alone would not tell you that the whole plot was Zionist, but it certainly suggests that there's a strong influence from Israel and from the Zionist component of the Jewish.
Well, especially when you look at what percentage they are of the entire population.
Yeah, more like 2%.
Yeah, if anybody, I mean, that's an interesting thought, is that, maybe somebody should sue for discrimination, because all of the highest levels of government are just, primarily Jewish people.
Yeah.
So I don't know, that might be able to make a good case for discrimination,
and
take our country back that way.
Yeah. Well, what do you suppose is the relationship in terms of the ultimate movers and shakers in this one world conspiracy between, say, the Zionists and the British? A lot of people like Joan Vion would say that England, in effect, or the Britain, in effect, controls the United Nations because all of the former crown colonies. When Britain gave up their crown colonies, they all got a vote in the UN, and they were all told that they could have their independence if they voted with England. Therefore, England has 43 votes at every UN vote, whereas, of course, the United States and all other countries only have one. So Joan Vion kind of thinks that it's a British conspiracy, this one-world conspiracy. Others think it's a Jewish conspiracy. Others think that maybe the two allied themselves in World War One in order to defeat the Germans. Do you have a take on that?
Yeah, I would vote for the British allied with the Russians, with the Russian Jews.
And when wouldn't, I mean, like you're saying, that then the Russian Jews were the Zionists?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and the reason why is because Russia, or the Soviet Union, Russia had 5 votes to the U.S. having 1 vote. And
you say Russian Jews, you're really talking about Eastern European Jews, right?
Well,
yes.
Was Trotsky and was it, I'm thinking the other one that was worked with him that went over, didn't they? Originate from the United States, or were they just trained here? What was the
background? There was, I think Trotsky did come over to the United States, but I can't remember if that was after the coup, if he had to leave when he lost the power struggle with Lenin, and he came to the United States.
I thought Trotsky went down to like Cuba or somewhere like that, but they were in the United States and then went over to Russia, and then after whatever took place, then somehow Trotsky ended up down in the Caribbean somehow.
Well, yeah, but the point is that Trotsky's real name is Bronstein, and that he was part of a Jewish network that fomented the Bolshevik Revolution. And there's a lot of data to support that, you know, all of the Politburo offices, 85-90% of the people that were ruling the early Soviet Union were all Jews.
Okay, and, but where did they originate from? What faction are you saying they came from?
I think the Khazars or something.
The Khazars, yeah. Khazaria was an ancient kingdom that apparently they had conquered much of central Eurasia. And the king was pagan, and the king looked around for a religion, and he decided they needed a religion, and he adopted the Jewish religion. But in fact, these people are not genetically related to the Hebrews at all. In fact, to call a modern Jew to criticize a modern Jew and then to have that Jew call you anti-Semitic is completely a misnomer. There's a number of people that have advanced this, including a Jewish author by the name of Arthur Kessler in a book called The 13th Tribe, and several others, Henry Ford, the international Jew. But the idea is that this group of European or Ashkenazi Jews are not related to the original Hebrews. Their native language was Yiddish, which is not related to Hebrew, and they are not genetically related to the Hebrews. So if they charge somebody with being anti-Semitic, that's completely bogus, because they are not Semites. The Arabs would be Semites because they're from that part of the world, but they are not Semitic at all. So it's a gigantic fraud. In fact, according to a number of these authors.
So, in other words, these people may have originated in another country under another background, but they were brought over here, trained, and then given money, and then sent back over to foment the revolution. And they changed their names, because I think Lenin changed his name too, didn't he?
I think I did see that somewhere, that he had a different name, but I don't know what it is.
The point is that they have shown that they can infiltrate and foment revolutions in a stealthy manner, that they have support from the international bankers because they're also Ashkenazi Jewish, and that there's a kind of a pressure from above and pressure from below strategy. So you infiltrate the society from below, you have revolutionaries, you have financial support from above because the Rothschilds are the richest people in the world. And, you know, in 1900, they owned half of the wealth of the world, supposedly.
Well, and that's something really interesting to look into. There's an organization called NED. It's the National Endowment for Democracy. And that was started during the Reagan administration. He's the one that wanted it. And NED is a grant maker, and they have... Basically, they fund four different entities. One of them is the International Democratic Union or Society, whatever. There is the International Republican Institute. There is the business, the Chamber of Commerce business angle, and then there is labor. So what they've done with this funding is to set up like turnkey democracy, quote-unquote democracy. And our government funds NED, and then NED in turn funds NGOs. And there is linkage, you know, actual written evidence linking NED to the color revolutions that have been going on all over the world. And I do have this documented on my website. You know, the reason I researched that was because in a speech of George Bush's, he mentioned how successful the color revolutions had been, and so I said, color revolutions, you know, so I did a search, and I found the Orange Revolution, that was the Ukraine. There is the Saffron Revolution, the Cedar Revolution, I think that was Lebanon, the Rose Revolution. Anyway, I found about eight of them, and there is a color for Pakistan, but I don't know what it is yet. But basically, our government is fomenting revolution in all these countries by way of NED. And what NED does is it funds the NGOs, and basically they just drop down in, just like you said, you know, from the bottom up, fomenting revolution from the bottom up, and while putting pressure from top down.
Well, that's interesting, because I certainly suspected the United Nations would be involved in something like that. But of course, according to people like I'm reading, that this country was very, very, there was a flood of Jewish immigrants into this country in the late 1800s. And by the early 1900s, according to some things I've been reading, they really had gained control of many of our institutions, including, you know, Wall Street and the press, Hollywood, by the early 1900s. And it is phenomenal to see the extent of infiltration.
Uh-huh.
Extraordinary.
Have you ever read the Protocols of the Elders of Zion?
The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, I've tried to read. That is so evil, I can only read about a paragraph at a time.
It certainly is, but you know what? That strategy is, it would work. It is working, and you can see the parallels with what's going on in our country with the protocols. And
seem to be the blueprint for world takeover.
Mm-hmm.
Although the official line is that this, of course, was a forgery and that it's not real. But, the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, if people can get a hold of it, it's not pleasure reading. It's very evil. It talks about how to infiltrate and take over. And it, you know, of course, uses all the Machiavellian strategies. The ends justify the means. You know, we control with money, divide and conquer, et cetera. It's very unpleasant reading.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've noticed that several of the books, the report from Iron Mountain, they try to, they have a disclaimer right in front of the book, but when you look at that book and read it through, they've implemented everything in it, and this was written in the 60s. But so a lot of these things, somebody either leaks out or however, and puts it out, and, you know, I mean, it's a blueprint.
Yeah, well, you have to get the game plan out to your players, you know, you have to. And so I do think that they write these things and they, you know, might put a little bit of disinformation in them so that they can be officially denied. But I think the inside players know that it's real, and then they know the strategy and, you know, what they're supposed to do.
Well,
and
Vicki, didn't you write in one of your articles that the report from Iron Mountain was put together by the RAND Corporation?
I thought it was, yes.
Yeah, okay. Yes. Well, I was getting that from you. So, mm-hmm. But, of course, that's also left as a little bit of a teaser. It's kind of mysterious. It's thought to have, you know, is it really real or not? You know, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was doing an interview just recently with Charlotte Iserbay, she was reading me a document from back at the teens in the last century, and it was everything that Iron Mountain was, you know, taken from.
Yeah, the strategies mm-hmm. involved in it. Yeah, I think these strategies are passed down generation to generation, and of course, you know, when things don't work, they jettison it and, you know, put a new strategy, and of course, technology helps a lot. I mean, we can see the effect of control of the media. I mean, we've got a whole country full of people that are walking around like zombies. They have no idea what's really going on in our country. And when you try to tell them or have them look at some of this stuff, they look at you as if you're absolutely nuts.
Yes. You know, I have to tell a little story here. In 2002, I wrote a piece which got on the internet somehow. It was called Reflections on the Origins of 911. And I just went through all the information I could find, and I looked at three scenarios. Number one, that the official story was true, that the Arab hijackers did it, and then I eliminated that, saying that that's not possible. Number two, kind of the Chomsky scenario, which is that, yes, the hijackers did it, but they did it because of all the terrible things that we had done in the Middle East over the years. And I eliminated that. And then the third one, of course, was that it was an inside job. And I came down on the side with lots of evidence that it had to be an inside job. And shortly thereafter, I got an email mysteriously from someone, I don't know who it was, but it was an article. And the email said, basically, welcome aboard. You know, you can be part of the club. And I downloaded the article, and the article was basically how we engineer society using financial levers, you know, interest rates and this and that, and saying that they could shock society into this response and into that response, like they were talking about some kind of a clinical process with a patient strapped down. You can do this, and then the patient will do that. You can do this, the patient will do that. And it had the same tone to me as the protocols. It was very evil, and I think I threw it away. I wish I'd kept it now, because I now see 911 as simply kind of a shock to the system in a kind of a social engineering sense.
Yeah.
One of many shocks that have been deliberately imposed.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, here's something interesting that I found in my research. I was looking at the supply chain systems that are being set up, and that's part of the transportation system, you know, the whole redesign of our transportation system that's being designed for importing, and a big part of that is supply chain management, and Lockheed is working in conjunction with a company called Hutchison Whampoa, or Hutchison Port Holdings. But there are these transportation projects all over the world, and it's all about supply chain. Well, what I realized with supply chain is that those supply chain management systems, what you end up with is a monopoly, because you have a consortium of all of the companies that have a piece of the supply chain of all of the products that you know the front end retailer sells. Okay, it's easiest to think about if you think about a computer like Dell computer. There are lots of components in a computer that are produced by different companies. But when somebody orders a Dell computer, that order generates orders all throughout the supply chain for every manufacturer that produces even the smallest part for that computer, right? Mm-hmm. So when you have a supply chain system, what ends up happening is that they become a cartel and a monopoly, because they won't allow, their goal is for them to all stay in business and to put other people out of business. And so I wondered if we have to break up those cartels, those monopolies, because we'll end up with only, you know, like one company supplying everything, because of the nature of the way that the supply chain works.
But doesn't that go against what was really being implemented? They're actually putting in these monopolies or these no competing bid contracts for these corporations that go in and, you know, for various projects and that sort.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's a way to form a natural monopoly, but you're doing it at a hidden level, because it occurs by way of computers at an administrative level. You really can't see that it is a cartel, that it is a monopoly.
Well, would that tie in with what you were talking about today that was taking place on C-SPAN and the auctioning of, was it infrastructure you're talking about or what?
Well, that's Paulson and Bernanke's bailout program. What their idea is basically to set up an auction situation. I mean, when I was listening to the hearing, I was listening midway through, and it sounded to me like what he was talking about was setting up kind of an eBay system to handle these assets from these, these junk assets from these Wall Street corporations. And later on when I was listening to it tonight, that's exactly what he was talking about, except that it's a reverse auction. And what the companies that are selling these bad assets would do is a reverse bid, you know, who can bid the lowest price to sell to the government. I mean, you know, it's really a mind twister to think about that, because when you think of bidding, you think of, you know, going high, but this would be a going low.
Well, that's a good deal for the government, isn't it?
Well, except that these are bad assets. Mm-hmm. You know, they're bad loans. And so but then Bernanke said something interesting later on, and I guess it has to do with the valuation of the assets that you're buying. You know, when it's the mark to market thing, and I'm really weak in this area, so if I say something wrong, stop me. But as I understand this, what it is that there are some assets that early on in the asset life, it has a very low value. But when you project out over time, the real value of the asset occurs later on in the life of the asset. And I'm not sure.
It's just the reverse, Vicki, but I'm not sure either. So,
not an area I'm familiar with either.
Yeah, well,
I guess maybe I brought up the wrong analogy here. I don't know.
Okay, but this is a very interesting topic, and I think people are on the edge of their seats if they're listening, trying to understand what's going on with the kind of the financial meltdown on Wall Street and the huge amounts of bailouts. Do you see this? How do you read all this? Is this just kind of standard procedure, fleecing of the flock, or do you see this as being more dire or more dire than usual?
I think it's more dire than usual. I think it's like D-Day for the capitalist system in America. It would give Paulson unprecedented control over these assets, and in those hearings he was talking about other corporations, it sounded to me like that he was talking about actually setting up an eBay system, and the description sounded to me like what they're trying to do is set up a new market mechanism. And it would be, I suppose, an additional market mechanism, but the taxpayers are going to, of course, be taken to the cleaners on it. I don't think it's a bailout per se. I think they want the money to actually back this new marketing mechanism that they want to establish.
Well, at the same time they're discussing all this on right now, there's also a huge omnibus bill going through. And my understanding, law, the Sea Treaty, or the Clean Water Act, of control of the world's water, is buried in this.
Yeah. Well, you can pick up just about any piece of legislation, and you can find a UN agenda item in it. And, you know, I don't know who writes the legislation in Congress, but all of this UN agenda is embedded in the legislation. The language is slightly different, but if you read it and try to understand the intent of the legislation, you'll see that the intent of the legislation corresponds to the UN agenda.
Right, so then you have to have a background in knowing at least what Agenda 21 is about so that you can at least find this and understand what's happening, correct?
Yes, and that's the hard part about explaining this, any of this, to people who are uninitiated, because you kind of have to have a base of knowledge to start from. You know, but once you can see it, I mean, once you understand how this whole system is kind of working, then you can pick up on it immediately. A person has to make the effort to get the foundation of understanding.
Well, as you know, most Americans are either overworked or overstressed or overspecialized in one way or another, and they don't feel they have the time or the energy to devote to researching these kinds of things like you've done, which makes it pretty tough to communicate.
It certainly does, and the only people I can really communicate with are my friends on the internet, and they're in the same boat. You know, we're kind of locked in because I can't discuss the weather with people anymore. You know, from my point of view, I see. You know, I see the world, you know, coming unglued. And I used to sit at my computer, you know, and I'd hear the, you know, lawnmowers going outside, and I'd go to the store, and it was totally surreal because, you know, all the people out there that outside of my house, you know, they're living life as if everything is normal, you know, and I get on the computer and it's like, you know, we're in World War IV already. and it's an intellectual war. And, you know, with people in this country so conditioned, I think they're suffering brain damage from watching TV. I don't know if you've I only have just a smattering of understanding of you know, what people have written about the part of your brain that processes images, and then the thinking part of your brain where you process what you read. And the people that have grown up entirely watching television, the thinking part of their brain is stunted.
There's another part that I'm just becoming acquainted with that I really want to delve in more, is the iconography part. Are you following what I'm saying? Symbolism?
No, what's that?
Like symbolism. Symbolism that speaks to us on a subliminal level that activates various things in the human psyche. Are you following what I'm even inferring?
Yes, I am. That's a very interesting thing.
And it's all around us, and on our normal level, we probably don't pay any attention to it, but it's speaking to us in at this level all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I noticed that, of course, because I, as a programmer, everything that I did was symbolic. When programmers work on code, it's all symbolic. And so it's almost like second nature for me. But, you know, when I've tried to point things that are symbolic out to people who don't think that way, they again look at you like you're nuts, you know. Yeah, I don't see anything there, you know. And I point it out and say, look, you know, it's right there, right in front of you.
Well, let me ask you this, Vicki. Are you a believer in any particular religion?
No, I'm not. I went to Sunday school when I was young, and I grew up as a non-Mormon in a Mormon community, and that kind of turned me off for organized religion forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they're very clannish, and they exclude non-members.
Right, right.
And so,
well,
you know,
I just am curious as to what it is that makes a person spend this much time and energy trying to shine a light where it needs to be shined. I guess spirituality and religion is, it may be a factor, but it also might be other intellectual or emotional factors that it would cause somebody to spend as much time in this kind of lonely endeavor, but of course, extremely, extremely important. And ultimately, I think probably you're motivated by and a desire to try to fix the problem.
I'm kind of maybe an over-exaggerated sense of responsibility. I don't know. I really don't know, but.
So there would be
an
altruism there. You'd rather not see the planet depopulated. Rather not see these guys win.
I just want people to be decent, you know. I just want a functioning society. I would like I would like just a normal functioning society where you have happy families and healthy and happy children and
right.
You know, just the normal thing, nothing spectacular. The interesting thing is I don't really find it lonely. I'm not the least bit lonely. This has been the most interesting thing I've ever done in my whole life. And,
stimulating.
I can spend days, if I didn't have to go outside of my house to shop, or to see my relatives on occasion, I would never ever go out. I would just stay in and do what I do because I'm just so totally. I hope there are no psychiatrists listening, but I am so totally engaged. It's almost like to the point of autism, I think, where I just have this single focus, this drive to expose what's going on because the evil in the world that I see coming at people is so monumental. And the thing is that once they get this control grid, this control system in place, there won't be any escape from it. So we're like, it's do or die time, folks, you know? We can't allow this to happen because they will have the controls on humanity forever.
Go ahead.
And with the computer systems that they're implementing, the control will be total. And that means the education system and the healthcare system. They're implementing a system of a national healthcare or national patient information records. Your medical record is going to be online. It's going to be accessible. And the NIH has plans to use that information for research and genetic modification. Supposedly, now, the way they present this, it's all very nice. You know, they're going to do genetic studies so that they can define the different types of diabetes so that they can do personalized treatment. But, you know, if you cut through the language and you see what they're really doing, what they're planning on doing is human experimentation and biological modification, genetic modification.
And I was hearing that a lot of it's going to be done through not only through medications, but also through diet. In other words, if you are deemed to be going to be maybe a policeman or whatever, you might be given a diet that accentuates the traits that they want.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've been experimenting on that kind of stuff on the soldiers. You know, making them aggressive. You know, giving them medications to make them aggressive. And, you know, just whatever behavioral trait they want you to have, if they understand the genetics of what makes a person behave that way, then they can induce that behavior. And what really scares me is that they will create a population of drones that their function in life will be to just worker drones, you know, like a beehive or an ant colony or something, where they're all working to serve the queen. And using genetic modification to do that sort of thing. And it's all perfectly possible. I mean, this is not sci-fi. This is all possible. All they need is the population to be able to experiment on, you know, using proteins to turn genes on, turn them off, that kind of experimentation, you know, and what compounds will cause them to be turned off and what's the duration and, you know, it's all possible.
Aldous Huxley called this the scientific dictatorship. So apparently our would-be masters are very intelligent and very plugged into technology and science and very, very good at capitalizing on all the tools that it gives them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've read a really interesting paper recently. I think it was called Mind War. And what they were theorizing is that 911 was an experimentation to see how the population would react when even though, you know, if you couple an emotional shock with an absolutely absurd explanation, how many people in the population will accept the absurd explanation? And it would appear that the vast majority of people did.
Now, the article is called Mind War.
Yeah, I'll send it to you because
that would be wonderful.
Yeah,
I'd like
to get that one.
It's really an interesting article.
Yeah. Now I've got to read you another quote. This is also put together by Christopher Boleyn. He's actually quoting Tom Paine, Thomas Paine, who in 1802 and 1803 had just gotten back from 15 years in Europe. And he said, "While I beheld with pleasure the dawn of liberty rising in Europe, I saw with regret the luster of it fading in America. In less than 2 years from the time of my departure, some distant symptoms painfully suggested the idea that the principles of the revolution were expiring on the soil that produced them." Then he says, "A faction, acting in disguise, was rising in America. They had lost sight of first principles. They were beginning to contemplate government as a profitable monopoly and the people as hereditary property."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That sounds like a pretty good description of America today.
Yes, it does. Yeah. And I've recently been looking into the history, you know, from about 1913, just before 1913 forward. And the bankers, you know, J.P. Morgan in particular, basically they did successfully change the structure of our government to enslave people, and it began with the income tax.
Yeah.
And I wasn't too hot on looking into the Federal Reserve, but, you know, everything that you look at, you have to be prepared and ready to look at it and accept the information. I don't mean accept unquestioningly, but I mean to be able to understand the information as it's being presented. And when I read that in 1913, what they did is they cut the tariffs in half, and they implemented an income tax on all American citizens and businesses. And if you go back to the beginning and you think about a time when the government's revenue was derived from tariffs and there were no taxes on people or businesses, and then you think, well, they cut the tariffs in half and they made up the revenues by putting an income tax on people, and at the same time they established the Federal Reserve, you can see that basically what they did was to indenture the American people to the Federal Reserve, you know, using people as their labor as collateral for an open line of credit for government.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know.
Yeah. But I have to tell you, Joan Vian shed a little light on this when she said that the first central bank was established in the early 1600s in Sweden. And then later in the 1600s, the Bank of England was formed. And then bam, 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 down the line, now to the point where all but about five countries in the world of 190-some countries have privately owned central banks. And, of course, the importance of the international banks, the IMF and the World Bank, are greater than ever now.
I think you could, you know, trace it all the way back to the biblical times and the money changers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm real weak in the biblical area because I'm not a religious person, but I do remember something about the money changers being run out of Egypt or something like that.
Run out of the temple by Jesus. That's the time he got very mad.
Well, it's gotten to the point we need to have some our closing comments here and call it an evening, but I really do again want to say thank you, Vicki, for your patience in getting this thing started tonight, but also for coming on the program. And again, I want to say the same for Dr. Carlstrom and taking the time to come on and share the evening.
Well, I've really enjoyed it. I just love these kind of free-flowing conversations, you know, where you can go from subject topic to topic to topic, because it is all connected.
Yeah, well, it's great to be able to do it with you, Vicki, because you know so much and you can shed so much light on it. So we really appreciate you and what you're doing. Can you just maybe wind up with a something that we can take home that's there's got some hope in it?
Oh, man, nothing like a tough assignment here.
What can we do that's going to help? What can we do? What can average people do?
Well, what I always suggest is pick a subject that somebody has an interest in and just feed them little bits and pieces of information. You know, you have to start with baby steps, you know, with people, and which is something that I'm really not good at all. So I'm preaching what I can't do myself, but just find out what they're interested in and give them little bits of information to try and pique their curiosity. Because if you can get somebody going on one topic, doesn't matter what it is, then you can lead into the others and get them awake. Because what we need is a massive awakening in this country. We need people to, you know, snap out of the dream sleep that they're in and see that there really and truly is evil in the world. It's here. And the agenda that they are working on is beyond my ability really to describe it. I don't have the words to describe what I see as being the future if we don't get this stopped. Okay,
so well, I guess we do need to say goodnight here, and I do again appreciate both of you coming on the program.
Well, thank you.
Well, great to talk to you. Good night, Vicki and Melody.
Okay, good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. This is KHENLP.